All right, the committee will come to order. Do we have minutes?
No.
Representative Broad, would you move the minutes from March 3rd? All right, Representative Broad moves the minutes from March 3rd. Any discussion? All in favor of those minutes, adopting those minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. We're going to do House File 2941 first. Representative Anzels. And I will move that House File 2941 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. And I understand there's a DE1 amendment that I assume you want on. So I'll move the DE1 amendment. All in favor of the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe it's 2914 rather than 2941.
Oh, I have 2941 on the bill. Okay. The Anzels bill is what we're moving.
Okay.
So, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, I have a... You should have a delete all amendment.
It's in the packet.
In front of you. This legislation... By the way, not only do I need a dental professional, but today I need a physician.
Yeah.
And thank you for taking this bill in out of order here. This bill was brought to me by the 3,500 dentists throughout the state of Minnesota. It involves the setting of rates. It involves a number of things, providing for care and... I'm just going to simply turn it over to Mr. Spizzetto from the Dental Association to explain this in a little more detail.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dominic Spizzetto. I represent the Minnesota Dental Association. And the bill before you is brought forth by the Dental Association, frankly, in response to an announcement by a very large national carrier who has a state entity that writes a good portion, if not 80% of the marketplace in dental insurance and dental contracts in Minnesota. And the announcement was that they were encouraging their state counterparts to begin a policy that they would discount fees across the board on all services, all dental services are provided. Now, as you know, all dental services are not covered generally by insurance. There are a wide variety of services, sometimes referred to as cosmetic, sometimes considered not medically necessary and then not covered by the plan. And those services are generally taken care of between the patient and the dentist today. Our concern is that in setting up contracts that would limit how that would how the dentist could determine the services, whether the patient could get those services, and how they were paid for under a contract that doesn't apply to those services is inherently unfair to the dentist and the patient. In cases where that would occur, just be cognizant of the fact that the dentist then would probably shift payments to those that don't have the benefit of these kind of extensions of contracts, particularly the seniors who have no dental insurance at all. So we think it's an equity issue for patients, and it's a fairness issue for the dentist engaging in that kind of a practice. So this legislation would prohibit dental insurer, dental organizations that provide dental insurance, from entering into contracts with dentists that restrict the dentist and the patient's ability to provide non-covered services, such as cosmetic services, and also limit the ability of the health or dental organization from restricting the fees or setting fee schedules for those services and leaving those to be as they are now with the patient and the dentist. Mr. Chairman, this does not apply to services that are covered that may not actually get full reimbursement because of a copayment or a deductible or an annual maximum. It only applies to services that aren't covered in the contract, but generally what we call cosmetic or non-medically necessary services. There is a provision in here on the delete everything that basically relates to the explanation of benefits that would require the health plans to provide information on those services, which we think is good. And then there is a section in here that was requested by Delta Dental Plans of Minnesota to indicate this doesn't apply to any contract for services provided to public programs or federal, or set up by state or federal government. So obviously this would not apply to Medicaid and MinnesotaCare. Mr. Chairman, with the new delete everything amendment, I was hopeful I could say there was peace in the valley, but I understand the entire valley is not happy with this legislation. But our primary goal in bringing this forth was directed, if I may be candid, primarily at Delta Dental Plans because of their large market share. And our major concern still relates to that. And I know they're here and they can speak for themselves on the language of the bill.
Questions? Representative Abler.
Just on the Medicaid exclusion, when I, if I want to charge a Medicaid or a Medicare patient, I have to let them know in advance it's not going to be paid for, and I think we're disallowed from even reducing it because it's a,
yes,
it's an enticement thing or something, which is a crazy rule. If I'm in jail sometime for reducing fees to a Medicaid person, you'll know why I'm there. But how do you handle the that under the paragraph, see what would happen to a Medicaid or a MinnesotaCare person in current law?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that this would apply in that situation anyway, but in the case that it could, because we are contracting with the state or we're contracting with health plans under PMAP to provide that, you could theoretically make a case that that would apply to dental providers under that. I don't think it does because the plan itself has the restrictions in it, not necessarily the contract with the provider.
Right.
I guess that's comfort language, and that's why we put it in.
I feel comfortable.
Representative Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Spazzetta, I just want to make sure that I understand this because I've heard kind of two different versions of how this might apply. One is the situation in which someone does have a dental insurance policy, and it would deal with the situation of a service or a treatment that wasn't covered under that policy, and there may or may not be discounts negotiated by the dental insurance provider, and that this is to control, to say the dental insurance company can't control those non-covered service prices. But the second is where you actually have uninsured patients, and that in signing up to be a vendor with a particular dental insurance company that brings you the majority of your perhaps covered patients, that by agreeing to a set fee schedule, you agree to provide it, use that same fee schedule for everyone, and so someone who's totally uninsured would not be able to get a discount. And if you could address, does that this bill address both of those situations, only one?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, to my understanding, it only applies to the first instance of a non-covered service under an existing dental plan. There's nothing in here that relates to fees that would be charged outside of a dental plan. It doesn't relate to what we call the most favored nation clause in some contracts, which says that this is your fee schedule, and this is the fee schedule you must charge everyone because you've submitted that to us. I don't think it relates to that at all. In fact, I'm not sure that practice is as prevalent as it used to be.
But, Mr. Chairman, just to that point, the most favored nation clause does, as far as you know, still exist in some contracts?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, to my knowledge, I don't think it does, but I could be wrong, and I'd have to stand down for, I think it applies more likely in medical contracts with providers, but I don't think that that's enforceable any longer. I could be wrong.
But that's not part of this bill.
No.
Do clinics negotiate these contracts, or are they just handed a contract?
Mr. Chairman, it sort of depends on who you're negotiating with.
Okay.
If you're negotiating with a provider, a dental insurance organization, where your patient population is 75% covered by them, the negotiations are fairly one-sided. If it's a small carrier that you have served in the past or want to serve in the future, that could be a different situation. But given the enormity of one particular plan's market share, they pretty much get what they want in their contracts. And that's why we're trying to do this, to prohibit that up front before it comes to Minnesota.
Okay. Well, Representative Huntley had an amendment that I'll move because he's talking about another bill. I don't use the word negotiation anymore. It's the A1 amendment, I think. Yeah. And it has to be amended on line 1.2. Instead of line 11, it should be line 10. Basically, this would have this regulation exclude the small carriers. So I'll move that amendment. Is there anybody who wants to testify about that? Mr. Lally, do you want to talk about that amendment at all?
I don't want to talk about that amendment. No, but just a
second. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Joe Lally. I'm the Vice President at Delta Dental of Minnesota. Just some correction on some history first and then on the amendment. Delta Dental of Minnesota was the only Delta Dental member of 39 Delta Dental plans in the Delta Dental Plans Association, the National Association, to vote against this proposal when it came up at the Board of Directors several years ago. So we've been working with, not against, but with the Dental Association. I can't think of the last time we worked together. We usually oppose each other on things, but we worked together on this because we too thought it was unfair to require dentists to give discounts on services that were not part of the covered benefit purchased by the group. We act as a fiduciary for groups. We represent or administer services for more than 4 million people who are employed by Minnesota-based employers. We have 60% of the PMAP program that we provide administration to through subcontracts with Medica, MHP, and Blue Plus. And so we've got a lot of volume of business, and we think it's overreaching to look at non-covered services and demand that a discount be applied to those services. An example of a non-covered service would be if General Mills, I work for General Mills, and General Mills bought coverage through us, and they didn't provide orthodontic coverage. So my kids are going to the orthodontist, and the orthodontist, because I have Delta Dental coverage, the orthodontist would have to give a discount, the negotiated discount on the orthodontia, as opposed to saying it's a non-covered service. You don't have that coverage, and so you pay for it privately. We don't think that orthodontist should have to take that discount. We do think, though, that if it's a covered service, there are basically two analyses, whether it's a covered service and then who pays for it. And the first is a schedule of benefits. So unlike medical, dental has a schedule of benefits. There's just basically a list. These things are covered, and things that aren't on that list are not covered. And so it's not a question of whether they're medically necessary. They're not a question of whether there's a reason for the coverage. The coverage that was purchased just has a limited benefit set. And on those pieces of coverage, even if Delta isn't paying for it, the patient still gets the discounted rate, the negotiated rate. And that would include things where the patient is paying a copay or a deductible, and even where the patient has exceeded his or her annual maximum. In dental, unlike medical, it's a relatively low cost and also a low annual maximum, depending on the coverage, $1,000, $1,500, $2,000 a year. And with a couple crowns in January, you can get there already. Your cleanings later in the year would still be covered services and you'd still be entitled to the discount. The only other thing that I want to say on the EOB piece, I guess one, that we work together. Two, that's covered versus non-covered services. I think we want to maintain that in Minnesota, and I should say other states have done this too. Rhode Island, Virginia, and currently in Washington State, there's similar legislation. If you don't contract for it, if you don't have the coupon, you shouldn't get the discount essentially. And if the employer isn't paying for it or the individual isn't paying for it, it's not a benefit that you bought. So it would be outside the coverage. And we think, along with the Dental Association, that it's overreaching to require that. On the amendment, I think the concern we have on the amendment is that the bill is proposed and negotiated over the last several months, in large part between our CEO and Dr. Templeton, who's the president of the Dental Association, creates a level playing field. And we don't know that other carriers not based in Minnesota should get a different set of rules. So,
Any other discussion on the amendment? Any questions for Mr. Latimer? Sorry. Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. Our members provide over 20,000 jobs in Minnesota, not including the thousands of agents that distribute our products. Our members write life insurance, long-term care insurance, annuities, and a handful of them also write dental insurance, which is why we're here today. I'm here in support of the A1 amendments. Our members currently do provide discounts on non-covered services. We think it's a valuable consumer benefit. We've been doing it in this market for over 25 years in some cases, and the employers that we sell these benefits to feel it's a very valuable service that we provide. Our members of the marketplace, you heard them talk about how large Delta Dental was. My members, no one writes over 10% of the market. In fact, most of them are under 5%. So we're not talking about the same market imbalance as you are with Delta. So there is a very lively negotiation between providers and the dental plans. And happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Spazzetto, so your folks could actually, your dentists could actually decide just not to contract with some of Ms. Rowan's providers because it wouldn't hurt their business as much as not being able to contract with Delta, right?
Mr. Chairman, that's probably true, yes.
Okay. Are there any other questions that people have on the amendment discussion? Yeah, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm not sure who to direct this to, but, you know, if Delta Dental thinks it's unfair to do this and doesn't want to do it, why can't Delta Dental just not do it? I don't understand, then, if we have this amendment and it says that we're going to let the smaller players go ahead and cap those non-covered services, and we're going to say Delta Dental can't. And Delta Dental doesn't mind. They think it's okay to not be able to cap. I don't understand then why we're passing legislation. Can't Delta Dental just not cap non-covered services?
Whoever.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the situation is that their national organization has directed them to do so. And without this legislation, I think they would have to do it. That's my understanding.
Further question?
No, thank you.
Oh. Representative Anzalos, do you have anything on this amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to inform the committee that I'm okay with this amendment.
Okay. Any further discussion? All right, seeing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Any further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 2941 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, Representative Reinert. I'll move House File 2913 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there a disinfectant up here?
No.
Representative Anzalos has been sick for a couple days now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I also have with me Tom Pender from House Research, who helped me work on this bill. You know, Mr. Chairman, if somebody wants to move the bill, I guess that
would be. I moved it already.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this is an issue that a constituent brought to me, and my depth of health care policy is not what yours is, so I'll try and explain the situation, and Mr. Pender is here to provide backup on the research aspects of it. But I've got a constituent in Duluth who's a retired disabled teacher. He's age 60, and he has polio. So he is on Medicare Parts A and B and Social Security because of his medical condition. He gets his health coverage through ISD 709, the school district. Currently, state law stipulates, and I think you might have this in your packets, that until the former employer reaches age 65, the former employee and dependents must be pooled and in the same group as active employees for the purpose of establishing premiums and coverage for hospital, medical, and dental insurance. So because of the state statute, he's required to pay active employee rates plus the additional cost of his Medicare premiums. He actually went to the school district and said, well, you know, why is that? I'm on full disability. I'm covered by Medicare Parts A and B. I only use the school district's coverage as a supplemental. And the school district gave him literally the statute and said, why don't you see if you can do something about this? And he came to me as his representative. So that's how we got to where we are today. I went to Mr. Pender, who did some research on this, and came back and said, yes, your constituent does actually have an issue here, and he helped me draft the bill. And what the bill essentially does is say, if you have a local government employee who is on full disability, covered by Medicare Parts A and B, they can be pooled as a retiree in order to provide them with a less expensive insurance option that they're just using for their supplemental coverage. And that's the essence of it, and I'll try and answer questions, but Mr. Pender is here to answer the ones that I'm sure I won't know the answers to.
Does anybody have any questions on the bill? Or is there anybody in the audience who wants to testify about it? I think everybody's pretty informed. So I will renew my motion that House File 2913 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. File 3035, Representative Dabney. And I'll move House File 3035 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. It's good to be back in front of your committee.
Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Do many people say that?
No.
I didn't think so. I thought currying favor might be a good place to start. Members, Mr. Chair, and members, I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 3035 to you today. What we have, what you have in front of you is a math problem. The state has established the MCHA fund the MCHA pool for high-risk individuals who are not able to find health care elsewhere. In the volumes of rules and regulations around that pool, we have put in 45 different exemptions to their otherwise policy of not covering pre-existing medical conditions for the first 6 months that individuals are part of the pool. Some of those are disease states that you might commonly be found in a pediatric population. Insulin-dependent diabetes, cystic fibrosis, hemophilia, hydrocephalus, muscular dystrophy would be examples of that, or that may commonly present in those years, as I've touched on, as well as less common but potentially very expensive diseases such as leukemia and HIV/AIDS. In addition, there are exemptions to the six-month prohibition on the treatment of pre-existing conditions for often difficult to treat behavioral disorders such as bulimia and anorexia and chemical dependency, which often may present initially in these pediatric years. What House File 3035 does is take us, rather than adding a 46th exemption, take us down to one, and that is if you're a pediatric patient, individual under the age of 18, and your parents are paying the premiums for your coverage under MCHA, you get the medical care that you need, with a recognition that often early and consistent care can, in the long run, be cheaper care for everyone involved and more effective for the patient in question. With me today to speak to their experience are two constituents of mine, Ann and Jesse Rail. Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And if you could just start by saying your name for the record and then proceed. Thanks.
Sure. My name is Ann Rail, and this is my husband, Jesse.
And we're here to talk actually about our son, Lincoln, who is right now 2.5 years old and has a diagnosis of autism. We're here to share a little bit about our experience and why the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association insurance plan is critical to us. Our son needs this state insurance safety net to catch him now, not 6 months from now. The first few months of our son's life were very uneventful. He was an exceptionally good baby, and he developed on his own timeline. We started to get seriously concerned about his development, like we no longer could make excuses for his gross motor and speech delays right around his first birthday. This began a long journey of assessments, both privately and through the early childhood special education system. During this time, we did neurological, genetic, endocrine, hearing, orthopedic evaluations and assessments. We didn't find any reasons for delays, but we did start him in physical and speech therapy at that time. It took months to get all of that underway. Lincoln didn't progress much with therapy at all. We began to get concerned about autism around his second birthday. After months of speech therapy, he started to lose words, and he was actually losing sign language that he had already learned. We talked to our pediatrician, and he encouraged us to pursue a neuropsychological assessment. And we knew that there would be a wait for an appointment, so we called the clinics that he recommended right away. The University of Minnesota's Autism Spectrum Disorders Clinic said that we could expect a wait of 6 to 9 months. This was a bit more than we had anticipated. The idea of waiting so long for an expert evaluation was incredibly frustrating. So by the time he had his comprehensive 2-day assessment at the University of Minnesota, we were already a year into our efforts to help our son. When they sat down to tell us that Lincoln has autism, they left us with a great deal of hope for the future. They also left us with a dizzying list of resources to pursue on our journey. But they made it quite clear that his prognosis is actually really very good. Now that we know he has autism, we can set him up with the right kind of therapy to make a difference for him. A behavioral therapy, an intensive behavioral intervention is what he needs. If Lincoln starts this therapy early enough, he has an excellent chance to live an independent, safe, and hopefully, like any parent wants, a very happy life. At this point, we felt like it was just a matter of following our doctor's orders. We had the diagnosis. The research clearly shows us the next step. We actually thought we were done waiting. We could start doing something, but we had to navigate the insurance. Our private insurance, our health partner's insurance, does not cover the therapy that his doctors ordered. So we started to learn quickly about other options, including medical assistance and the MCHIP program. The parental fees were far too great for our family in the medical assistance program, so we enrolled Lincoln in MCHIP. We filed the application and he was accepted. We actually have our insurance cards. We've begun to pay our premiums in addition to our family's regular health insurance premiums. And we're still now looking at a 6-month wait to start him in therapy. Whether a child has autism or any other pre-existing condition, they should not have to wait 6 months for what is a safety net to catch them. Children who have developmental disabilities and special health care needs, they need help now. For our son Lincoln, we know that early behavioral intervention, as early as possible, is critical for good outcomes. His future literally depends on it. And it's incredibly sad as a parent to know that we could be doing something to help him, and we have to wait yet another 6 months. It may not seem like a long time to you, 6 months, but when it's related to the treatment that your child needs and you know you can't give it to him, it's incredibly, incredibly tough. It's really actually difficult to describe what it's like as a parent to know there's something you could be doing and you're unable to do it. For Lincoln, waiting any longer is costly, both to us personally, but also to us as a community. We all want good outcomes, and these changes would simply allow us to better achieve those good outcomes. So I urge you to vote to pass this bill.
Are there questions, members? How much is that therapy, if you don't mind me asking?
How much is the therapy itself?
Yeah.
I actually don't have an answer
okay.
to that.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for coming down and talking to us about this. It is a really important issue, and I know enough about the subject to I believe that the therapy that you're talking about, you know, is very well supported with evidence, and, you know, I accept that. I think it's very important that people get this. But my question to you, though, is you said you were talking about waiting the 6 months, and kind of following on Representative Thiessen's question, what would stop you? I mean, presumably it's expensive, but couldn't you start the therapy on your own dime or borrow the money or, you know, I'm sure many people wouldn't have the resources, but some surely would, to be able to start the therapy during the 6 months? I mean, do you have to actually literally do nothing during the 6 months while you're waiting?
Well, he's continuing in the therapy he's in, but it's not the therapy that he needs. And we couldn't privately pay it. We're talking about hourly costs. I'm not clear what the average is, but we're talking about hourly costs of $60, $70 an hour at anywhere from 35 to 40 hours a week for a kiddo Lincoln's age. And there's also overlap in staff and supervision time, so it's not even just that straight hourly rate for the therapy time, but there's multiple people involved in that therapy, so we definitely couldn't privately pay for what he needs now.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, another response to your good question is they are paying for it. They're already paying for it now as by paying the premiums for MCHA. They're just not receiving what they're paying for.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Mr. and Ms. Prohl, I'm totally sympathetic to the challenges that you've faced, both in terms of just the lack of provider capacity to even figure out what the problem is, let alone figure out what the next step is, which is a different issue for us to control. But you mentioned that you would be eligible for medical assistance. I assume that would be under the TEFRA option, but that was more expensive to you than going on AMCHA. And that is a concern for me because the MA program, which is TEFRA, which allows people to get onto medical assistance without having to spend down all their assets, so it expands to much more than is typically eligible, earns 50% federal funding. And so the situation is to take someone from a program in which we have 50% federal funding and putting it potentially in a program where we have already a 40-some million dollar deficit. And so the issue is not about should they get care or not, it's about the math problem of which resources and how. And the other issue we have is that we've heard testimony on this particular issue, and not all of our insurers are the same as yours in terms of turning it down. And we have a policy issue of if we believe something is good, credible, medically supported care, then shouldn't every insurance policy in Minnesota cover it? And not if your employer happened to go with A versus B, all of a sudden you're thrown into dependency on publicly funded health care. And so it's a complicated issue that unfortunately is this as complicated in your life as finding that right diagnosis and the right person to help you figure out how to get your son succeeding in life. And so I think we're going to need to talk about those financing issues, even though they're really not your problem. You need access to care. We need to get your son into the right place. But I think we need to wrestle as a committee because we have gaps in the private sector. We have issues of transferring fiscal obligations from the private sector to the public sector. We have two different public programs, one of which is Advantage in earning federal dollars. And so I think we have to wrestle with this one a little bit.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, from Mr. and Ms. Roel. Quick question in terms of your health partner's coverage. Did they not have any autism coverage, or did they not have behavioral therapy, or did they not have the hours or type of behavioral therapy? If you could give us a little more clarification on that, that would be helpful.
Yeah.
You need to introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I'm Jesse Rail, Lincoln's father. In regards to your question, the health partners policy is through my work. Our whole family is on that. And the coverage does not, it specifically states it excludes intensive behavioral therapy, which is another name for ABA therapy. So there is actually language that excludes that therapy, which is the, to our understanding, the one of the only and best researched evidence-based treatments for autism. So, you know, it will cover his speech therapy, it will cover his occupational therapy or physical therapy, but as far as really addressing the symptoms of autism, not really at all. No.
Further questions for these witnesses? Okay. Well, thank you for coming down today.
Thank you.
Yeah. And then you have another testifier?
No, Mr. Chair.
Oh, there's a Rick Hole.
Oh, I'm not sure that he was able to make it. I'm sorry. I know we forwarded his name to the committee.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Gruber wanted to testify on the bill. I know. Is there any? And why don't you come on down?
And I, Mr. Chair, if I may, I will share that the nice folks from MCHA and I have tried to connect this week, and we've just had no success.
Okay.
It's one of those weeks.
It is.
Okay.
Oh, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. First of all, I must correct. My name is Lynn Gruber, president of the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, and I need to correct the representative's math. The diseases that he was referring to are called presumptive conditions. There are some 40 presumptive conditions whereupon a physician's signature that the applicant has that condition. The applicant does not have to go out and get a rejection from a health insurance company or an agent. But it does not mean that those folks that have those conditions have an exemption from the pre-ex waiver. So let's correct that. If I could, do we have a page available?
Yes. He's coming down there behind you.
What I'm passing out, it's in the application, and it indicates the 13 waivers to the general rule that there is a six-month waiting period for pre-existing conditions that were diagnosed or treated 90 days prior to the person's application. And I can go through some of those if you'd like. But I will speak for the board of directors. We do oppose this legislation. I sympathize with our testifiers here, but I have lots to say on the subject. The subject of autism is very controversial because there are some controversial treatments. And the truth of the matter is there are only two plans in the state of Minnesota that cover ABA or LOVAS treatment, which these parents desire for their child. There is all kinds of other types of treatment, and some providers of autism blend some of the ABA and LOVAS with their other type of treatment. I would refer to the Fraser School as a very respected organization that could treat them right now, because I'm fairly certain that their health partners policy does cover treatment for autism. It just doesn't cover ABA or LOVAS because some insurers feel that it's experimental or that it is, and therefore they do not cover it. As I said before, it's somewhat controversial. The Department of Commerce, representing consumers, felt that because there's no strong evidence that any one particular type of autism treatment is the silver bullet, that they would like MCHA to cover that. And of course we do. In fact, we do, to the point of having 94 children that have autism. The vast majority of them have come from either self-insured plans that don't offer coverage for ABA or an insurance plan. And basically what the parents do is they benefit shop for their children. Now, I respect the parents for doing that, but it's a very costly treatment that these folks are wanting to undergo. In fact, I can give you our numbers, and I think it's important to understand the numbers, because I am convinced, and we've done a lot of field work at MSHA, going visiting all of the ABA providers and the non-ABA providers to understand what they do, how they do it, and how they're paid for it. And basically, the kids that end up going to ABA providers will be paying, that's correct, about $60 to $70 an hour. It's very intensive. Probably the biggest provider of this type of treatment in the state requires that most children come there for 8 hours a day, every day. When those children do that, that's about $55,000 a year. Now, if this treatment, I guess I'm going to give you a philosophical question, if this treatment is terrific and the best, then all health plans should be covering it. Well, but I don't know if that's
and let
that's
me just ask
issue.
Let me ask mm-hmm. you a couple of questions, because I don't know, I mean, and maybe this is all about autism, because maybe that's kind of where this situation comes up. But the exceptions we have from the pre-X, the six-month waiting period right now, are all situations where the person has lost other coverage. And the reason we have the mm-hmm. six-month waiting period is because we don't want people to not get insurance and then get sick. And it's just like in any other insurance market where that's
yes.
it's the same reason, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I
okay.
understand. I'm not confused.
I want to make sure that okay. we get all this on the record, and so that's what the purpose of the pre-X paragraph is. And the exceptions we have are all situations where people had insurance, so they're not. It's not the situation where they're. What's the word I'm looking for? Someone help me. Where you don't get insurance and then you get sick and you then go and buy adverse selection. Well, it's not exactly adverse selection. There's another word for it. But anyway. Moral hazard, right. Thank you. And so that's, as I'm looking at that, that seems to be the case here. Would that be accurate? That these are all situations where people had insurance and then lost it for one reason or another.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think that's correct, which then points out what we have here today, which is a couple, a very small proportion of society that wants this particular type of treatment for their child that can't get it through the plan that they have. And to say that all children should be waivered, I think, is going way overboard. In terms of, you know, putting another pressure on MCHA without paying for it in a public fashion is exacerbating the problem, where once again our $150 million worth of losses this year are going to be paid by companies that only represent 28% of the market. Just the companies that are fully insured. Self-insured companies do not help us pay the assessment. So what you're doing is you're if you do this, you're going to open the floodgates, and you're going to see more folks benefit shopping because their self-insured plan doesn't cover something they want, and MSHA does. Or you might have more parents, and I don't blame these folks for doing the best for their child. That's commendable, absolutely. But I'm just telling you, it has an enormous potential financial impact on us, for which we see no help from the state or at this juncture from the Fed. So these are the concerns.
No, and I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you. I'm just, I want to make sure we get that piece out, and it's not just about autism.
Right.
So Representative Abler.
Thanks, and thanks for coming again. Just to understand the bill and something else, if these folks were eligible under normal rules and they came in and had 6 months of waiting time, would you cover this ABA treatment then?
Yes, and that is what, excuse me, Mr. Chairman and Representative Abler, indeed, that is what we are doing now. I said we have 94 kids that are receiving autism treatment. Probably 80% of them are receiving ABA or low-vis treatment.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative.
And so it looks like the issue is a six-month delay. Is the, I don't know all this treatment stuff, but is there, does it get done after a while, after 1 or 2 years or some like the time you complete the treatment?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Abler and a representative might want to speak to this too, but the folks that provide ABA treatment believe that there's a few years, and these are the critical years, about 2.5 to about 5 or 6, that the child needs this before they can go into school. So it's pretty intense for possibly 2 to 3 years.
And so if it's time limited, it seems like to me this is more of a shift than a new cost. And so maybe if you had a 10-year fiscal note on this, this bill would just shift the cost up front. You'd have interest or something, but maybe the cost wouldn't be the full price of the treatment. Is that possible?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't believe that's right. I mean, Most of our members, the top 3% produce 80% of our costs. So a person that has $50,000 or more per year is considered a high-cost person. And if these children are averaging $55,000 a year, they're in that more costly averaging percentage of it.
Mr. Chair, just maybe my point wasn't clear, but it seems like if they're going to be getting this treatment in 6 months, that the $25,000 of the cost would have been on the back end of the last 6 months, maybe, instead of being a new cost to that case. The case might cost $150,000 or something, and you're going to pay the $150,000 starting today or pay that money starting in 6 months. Is that not correct, or am I on the wrong track?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abel, you can look at it that way, but I also want people to look at it another way, and that is there are treatments for this child and any other child that is delayed by a pre-existing waiting period, good services. And I wish that the parents would look at that because, like I said, we've done field work going around to these various providers, and we're extremely impressed with what they have. So, this is not a situation where the disease has no, there's no recourse. They have nothing they can do. They can find services, just not as intense as they may want. And I will say again, there's no clinical evidence in any journal that we can find that ABA or LOVAS is any better than any other type of, well, I'll call it multi-phasal type of treatment out there. So.
Okay. Any other questions, members? I think right now I'm going to lay this bill on the table so that we can work out maybe a better arrangement that's a little more narrowly tailored to address some of the concerns that were raised. I don't know if we need to do a motion to do that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Devney.
Mr. Chair, my understanding from my chair training is it's easiest and cleanest for everyone if you simply lay the chair on the table using your authority as chair rather than move to a motion.
We'll just lay it over then. All right. Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Representative Kahn, House Bill 2761. I will move that House Bill 2761 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman and members, this may be the first time I've appeared before this committee. It's a much more heart-wrenching committee than mine. But I got involved in this issue because I agreed to be a member of the Community Advisory Board to the Masonic Cancer Center at the university, and then got involved in the issue of clinical trials, which is something that's really important for evidence-based based medicine. One of the things that we talked about is this paradox that clinical trials are used to discover new and better ways to prevent, diagnose, and treat cancers. About 85% of children with cancer participate in clinical trials, but less than 5% of adults with cancer participate in clinical trials. So we started to try and get at the reason why, and there are lots of reasons, but one of the things that we discovered was I think there are now about 22 states that have that one of the problems is the coverage, not for the expenses of the trial, but for routine health care needs that might occur in the course of the trial. And so I've asked, I would like the bill to be explained by Mr. Pender from the research group who helped research the bill and look at what other states were doing and came up with this bill.
Mr. Pender.
Him explain it.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Tom Pender from the House Research Department, and as Representative Kahn said, she asked me to give a brief intro and background on the bill and so on. And members of the House Research Department don't take positions on anything, so I'm not speaking for or against the bill.
Understood.
Representative Kahn contacted me last fall and asked me to draft a bill on this subject. She asked me to, I'm just kind of giving the background of where it came from. She asked me to look at the laws of other states and draft a bill based on based on the best language I found in the laws that have been passed in other states or that I could make up myself, I guess. And I got copies of the bill, the laws that have been enacted in other states. There are about 23 of them. And there were a couple things that were kind of surprising about this process to me. First of all, I've drafted lots of bills involving health care insurance mandates, and usually we're the first state to do it, or one of the very first, and I haven't really looked a lot at the laws of other states, and I've just kind of sat down and wrote. And often they can be very, those bills can be very short, just a couple sentences sometimes. But in this case, I found that 23 other states already have this mandate. And the first one was in 1994, and there was a slew of them in about 1998 to 2002, and then the rest of them at other times. But anyway, so I looked at these 23 bills, read them, took notes, put them in various piles depending on, you know, sorting them on what they did. And that's kind of where the bill came from. I sent a draft to Representative Kahn asking her for, you know, did she want this or that? She gave me some feedback on it, and that's where the bill came from. I'm going to just walk just quickly through the bill, focusing on just the highlights, because I know Representative Kahn has some witnesses here who actually know more about this stuff. As is the case with most bills, the definitions are really the key part of the bill. And so I'll just direct your attention to the definition of clinical trial, and that it, for one thing, it doesn't just involve trying out treatments of a disease. It can try out other things, too, like screening, prevention, and diagnosis. And then I'm going to move down here to line 1.20, the non-routine patient cost definition. And that's basically a definition of what would be required to be covered under this bill. And it's basically things that, expenses that the patient would have had if they hadn't been in the clinical trial and were receiving coverage from their normal provider and being reimbursed by their health plan. So it has a list of things here that are considered non-routine patient costs. And there are about eight of them. Yes, there are eight of them. And basically, they're things that things that cost more because the patient's in a clinical trial instead of getting care through their normal sources. And so those are the non-routine patient costs that are not required to be covered under this bill. And then going on to page 2, line 13, it gives a definition of qualified clinical trial. And this was sort of a new world to me. I hadn't really known much about clinical trials before, and put together a definition here based on the concept that these trials would have to be approved by some reputable group that regularly deals with clinical trials and approves and sponsors them. Then the definition of routine patient care in line 24. Routine patient care cost, that's basically the thing that is being covered, the thing that is would be incurred anyway. At the bottom of page 2, there's the requirements for qualifying under this bill to be covered for the clinical trial itself. And it has to be if you look on line 2.34, it has to be something to prevent or detect, do early detection or treatment or palliation, that's pain relief of cancer, or treatment of a life-threatening condition other than cancer. And then there are some other criteria here. There has to be no clearly superior non-investigational treatment alternatives. In other words, no conventional treatment looks promising, and the data, continuing on the next page, the data provides a reasonable expectation that it will be at least as effective as the next best alternative, and the treating physician has to give an opinion that this would be, it's reasonable to expect a medical benefit outweighs or is worth the risks involved of participating in the clinical trial. And so that's basically the bill. Subdivision 3 is just some kind of footnote kind of things in the bill. Paragraph C, starting on 3.12, does say that this is subject to provider agreements between the providers doing the clinical trial and the health plan company. And if they have an agreement, a provider agreement with the health plan company, that applies to participation in the clinical trial. And so that's the walkthrough of the bill.
Any questions on the contents of the bill? Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Mr. Pender, I'm not as familiar with clinical trials and how a normal exam or checkup would be part of it or how that would be paid for. Are trials typically paid for by outside sources? I'm thinking if this is care they're receiving as part of a trial, isn't that care already covered by the funding for the trial? Just looking for some education on this.
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gottwald, maybe Representative O'Connell ought to answer this too. But
I think the people who are coming to testify are probably better able to answer that question. They have more experience with how this works in the real life setting.
Okay. Other questions? All right. Well, why don't we go move on to that? Thank you, Mr. Pender. Ms. Bowen? Well, and I would just, Representative Gottwald, look at line 2.3 and 2.4 in the non-covered services, which are costs that are reimbursed or eligible by the sponsor of the study, would not be covered.
Mr. Chairman and members, the person who's going to be testifying is Marva Bowen, whom I met in my service on this community board, and
my name is Philip McClave. I'm the Deputy Director of the University of Minnesota Masonic Cancer Center and a clinical investigator.
And he's actually really, he's not here to testify. He's here to answer questions.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I would like to thank all of the people who spoke to me over the past week about this legislation. David Ahrens and his team from ACS, Catherine Commit and several other members of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and Marilee Rose of CCOP, which is a community oncology program doing clinical trials. All of them had different perspectives and key information that have helped me in preparation for this testimony. I am here today because my husband is a cancer patient who has participated in clinical trials. His cancer history is a very long one, and it illustrates well the importance of clinical trials in moving forward new treatments. In the late 1960s, he was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. I have a nursing textbook from that era that says Hodgkin's disease affects mostly young people and is uniformly fatal. Chris was treated with very aggressive radiation therapy. He received about five times the amount of radiation we would allow today, and it almost all went to the left side of his head, neck, and chest. As a result of all this radiation, the nerves in his shoulder were severely damaged and his left arm permanently paralyzed. Neither he nor I blame the physicians who treated him. They were desperately trying to save his life, and they had few options. Unfortunately, the radiation did not work, and his parents were told by one of his physicians there was nothing left to do. One of his other physicians had a different opinion. He had talked with Dr. B.J. Kennedy at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Kennedy had treated 60 lymphoma patients with the chemotherapy regimen, and the outcomes were good. Chris was treated with his regimen and went into remission and has never had a recurrence of the lymphoma. Today, about 80% of patients with Hodgkin's disease are cured, thanks to researchers like Dr. Kennedy. Chris was cancer-free until the mid-90s when he was diagnosed with a bladder cancer. That cancer was most likely related to cyclophosphamide, one of the chemotherapy agents he received. Oncologists now use a drug called Mesna to counteract the effects of cyclophosphamide on the bladder. In 1999, he had a surgery to remove the bladder, a procedure which until the 1960s had a mortality rate of approximately 60%, but became increasingly safe as surgeons refined this procedure. Mortality rates now fall in the 1% range. He did not require additional treatment, and he has not had a recurrence of the bladder cancer. However, in the fall of 2008, in a routine follow-up CT, it was noted that he had a spinal tumor. The tumor was at first thought to be a recurrence of his bladder cancer, but a few months later, it was discovered that he had a tumor in the left parotid gland, which is the gland that swells up when you have the mumps. It was determined through additional testing that the spinal tumor had come from the parotid gland rather than the bladder. Parotid tumors are normally treated with surgery and radiation, but radiation was not an option in this case because of the large doses he had received previously. There are no standard chemotherapy protocols for cancers of the parotid. Chris was asked to participate in a clinical trial using three drugs. Cisplatin, which is a very old chemotherapy agent and has been approved by the FDA for a very long time and used for numerous cancers. Pemetrexed, which is a newer agent, but which has been combined with cisplatin in numerous trials and has been approved for use with cisplatin in lung cancer. And sorafenib, which is a newer FDA-approved drug for renal cell cancer. The drug company was paying for the sorafenib because it had not been used with the two other drugs previously. This was the experimental part of the study. Given his positive experience with new agents in the 1960s, Chris was happy to be given the opportunity to participate and was pleased to know he could receive some treatment that had potential benefit. Pre-authorization from our health plan was sought and given, and he got the first cycle of chemotherapy. Just before he was scheduled for the second cycle, we were notified that the insurance might not pay for the pemetrexed. Pemetrexed costs about $9,000 per dose and is given every 21 days. In my mind, I was adding up how much it would cost for a year's worth of treatment and also running through all the possible scenarios for obtaining the money. Chris was tolerating the chemotherapy quite well, had started to put on weight, and the facial pain he had been experiencing earlier was gone. It was a great relief to us when we learned the day before the second cycle that the insurance had indeed determined that they would pay for the pemetrexed. It was a good outcome, but very nerve-wracking to say the least. I think it would have been better if they had not pre-authorized it and that we could have appealed it, because at least then we would have known what we would be paying for. We were repeatedly told that our health plan was among the best in providing coverage for clinical trials by our providers. This makes me wonder what other people are experiencing. Dr. Brenda Weigel, who is a pediatric oncologist at the university, has said that almost all of the children she treats initially receive denials for clinical trial coverage of routine care. She and the other oncologists spend many hours providing information to health plans in order to get care for patients on clinical trials. Without clinical trials, we would not have the 80% survival rate we now have for children. We are on the threshold of a new era where the drugs used to treat cancer are less toxic and cancer treatment is becoming more individualized as we recognize certain cancers respond to certain drugs or combination of drugs. In 2001, the legislature mandated a work group to look at developing a voluntary agreement for health plans to cover routine health care costs associated with cancer clinical trials. This voluntary agreement was published on February 28, 2002. The nonprofit health plans in Minnesota participate in this agreement, and it appears that they not only abide by the agreement, but have actually determined that covering cancer clinical trials is not raising their costs. The problem is that self-insured entities are not part of this agreement. Self-insured entities are large corporations or institutions who can fund their health care because of the large pool of employees. Self-insured entities account for about 40% of the health plans. These health plans look like they come from the nonprofits, but in fact, the self-insured entities make the decisions about what to cover when they contract with the nonprofits to administer the benefits, and they can opt out of state mandates. In spite of this, I think we should go for a mandate. One of the problems with the voluntary agreement is that very few people know about it. The nonprofit health plans know about it, and other work group members such as ACS, lobbyists, physician representatives from the University of Minnesota Mayo, and other clinical groups like CCOP know about it. They have made not much effort to keep this agreement or the issues it raises in front of the public. One thing that struck me about the members of this work group was that there were no patient representatives visible from the patient-run advocacy groups like Minnesota Ovarian Cancer Alliance or Minnesota Breast Cancer Coalition. When I asked about this at a meeting with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, I was told lots of people were invited but decided not to participate. I find this a little hard to believe, knowing what I know about patient advocates. So. In addition, patients and physicians don't necessarily know when they get a refusal that it is the self-insured entity doing the refusal, not the nonprofit whose name is on the insurance card. This creates an image problem for these companies who are actually doing what they can to get patients enrolled in trials. The nonprofit health plans are opposed to this legislation because they don't really want a mandate for what they already are doing voluntarily, and they believe that the self-insured entities will dig in their heels even deeper in refusing to pay. I, on the other hand, believe this is, that a very healthy, open discussion about clinical trials is just what we need, and this legislation could be the catalyst that encourages that discussion. I did hear one very interesting story as I talked with people about this legislation. One person told me that their work group had an exclusion for clinical trials, that they were self-insured, and they changed that. So the employees changed it. And I think people who don't know about this can't do anything to change it, so we need to make it a more open discussion.
Thank you. Representative Kahn? Any questions, members? Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to have confirmed if what I heard was the case. I thought what I just heard was that the area of the market that we have jurisdiction over already has a voluntary agreement to do this.
They do.
And the area of the market we will have no control over and cannot mandate does or does not do this. In your case, you gave the story about the $9,000 drug. Were you operating in the part of the market that's the voluntary agreement, or were you operating in the part of the market that was the self-insured that we can't influence?
Ms. Bowen.
I was in the self-insured.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions, members? Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Schmidt and Ms. Rose. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, committee members, this is my first time testifying. My name is Marilee Rose, and I am the director of the Metro Minnesota Community Clinical Oncology Program. We represent 15 hospitals and clinics in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area and then outside the area in Hutchinson, Minnesota. We've been in existence for 26 years. We are federally funded program by the National Cancer Institute and also by supported by the membership of all of the hospitals. I guess I'm here to maybe, I'm definitely, regarding this bill, I want to just be clear that I have worked in cancer care, cancer research, oncology, clinical trials for over 25 years. I'm passionate about providing appropriate cancer care to patients. I've been affected personally, friends, family, and currently, as I said, work in a program where we support the enrollment of about 700 patients a year to cancer clinical trials. I was not involved in the development of the first voluntary agreement because I've only worked at the CCOP for the past 3 years. I can tell you that in verifying insurance, we have all of the support from the fully insured plans. Cancer care is covered with patients that have plans that are written as fully insured. We track denials very carefully, and again, it's about 10% of the patients that we see that go on clinical trials. I agree, it is a huge problem that more patients aren't going on clinical trials. The answers that we see could be achieved much earlier, but clinical insurance is only one really small part of why patients don't go on clinical trials. There's numerous reasons. That would be a whole nother day's discussion. But in terms of tracking denials, the problems that we see over and over again are denials by self-insured companies that have policies that not only exclude care that's experimental, but I've seen the letters, very threatening letters to patients, that if they participate in a clinical trial, all of their care will be paid for. And there's a lot of irony in that, because oftentimes drugs are provided by the sponsor or by the National Cancer Institute. So in essence, if you enroll on a clinical trial, there could be some cost savings to an insurer. The other real huge issue is that as a community research program, we review protocols very carefully for what is standard of care, what would happen to you as an individual outside of a clinical trial, and anything that is considered extra or part of the research plan, we assure that it is not billed to an insurance company. We've had meetings with many...
And we should just be clear, because we're just talking about self-insureds here, so it's really billed to the employer, it's not the insurance company who's making the decision one way or the other here. It's the employer who negotiated the deal with the insurance company, right?
That's correct. Okay. Mm-hmm. So in essence, the problems that we're facing right now are totally with self-insured plans. So, I mean, I fully support the concept of raising awareness and doing what we can. My concern in speaking here today is that we do have a plan in place, and I would hope that in any consideration that whatever decisions are made, that that doesn't impact something that is working very well for us.
Okay. Questions for the witness? All right, Ms. Kmit.
Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Kmit, and I represent the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, which is made up of 7 nonprofit health plans. I do have a handout for the pages, something you've seen before. It's a copy of the pie chart that shows where Minnesotans get their health insurance. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 2761, and I also want to thank Representative Kahn, Dr. Doug Yee from the University of Minnesota, and his colleague, Marva Bowen, and some of her other colleagues at the University of Minnesota who were gracious enough to meet with us, and some of my colleagues to discuss this legislation. Our concerns about this bill, as written, is that it is extremely broad. The scope includes all types and all stages of clinical trials, and it is not limited to cancer. We also have serious concerns about how to ensure that these are legitimate, quality clinical trials. And as you've heard already, a voluntary agreement was developed, and in that process, various stakeholders met with cancer specialists and other medical experts to develop a policy that ensured only high-quality cancer clinical trials would be included in the agreement. I want to be clear that the health plans support medical research and innovation to develop new and efficacious therapies. At the same time, we must be assured that these clinical trials are of the highest quality and that the cost of the actual testing of these drugs and treatments is not shifted to those who purchase health insurance. There was then, and there still is today, concern that pharmaceutical companies and or medical device companies would seek to shift the cost of the experimental treatments to the payers or the insurers as they test out their drugs and devices, which, if successful, would benefit these companies in the millions or billions of dollars in revenue. In the year 2000, a bill to mandate coverage of routine costs of care for patients enrolled in clinical trials was considered. And based on how that bill was drafted, we had concerns that if enacted, it would add more to the cost of fully insured products purchased by small employers and individuals. In addition, the bill would have affected only those patients who were enrolled in fully insured plans, which is illustrated in this graph, the 27%. And I would add that I think this 27% is likely smaller or a lower number today, since the number of uninsured in Minnesota are now estimated at 9.1% of our population. So this mandate that was discussed several years ago, as well as this mandate we're talking about today, would have left out the majority of Minnesotans outside of the scope of the mandate. We agreed, as health plans, we agreed it would be in the best interest of Minnesota patients, consumers, and purchasers for health plans to cover the costs of routine patient care provided to patients who are enrolled in reputable, high-quality clinical trials. To avoid any violation of antitrust laws, study language was developed requesting the Commissioners of Commerce and the Health Department to convene a meeting of stakeholders to discuss the possibility of facilitating a voluntary agreement on this issue between all major purchasers, including insured and self-insured plans, as well as the Minnesota Department of Human Services and the then Minnesota Department of Employee Relations. A similar agreement had been reached the year before in the state of New Jersey. And today, besides Minnesota and New Jersey, voluntary agreements also exist in Nebraska, Michigan, and Georgia. So at the time that Tom Pender was referencing, there was a slew of legislation and mandates were passing in other states. There was also an effort to pass or to construct voluntary agreements in a number of other states, and Minnesota was one of those states. After months of extensive discussion of definitions and alternative approaches, the work group recommended a voluntary program to cover the routine care provided in cancer clinical trials. The work group believed that a voluntary program was preferable to passing a mandate, in part because it would better accommodate changing science, technology, and medical practices in a timely manner and ensure that patients would have access to the best care available. And it would likely include many more cancer patients who are covered by large self-insured employers. The point here is that when we, as health plans, work with the community and come to understand how medical science is evolving and changing, we welcome the opportunity to update our medical policies to reflect that, and that's exactly what we did. Cancer clinical trials have the most rigorous standards and oversight probably of any disease group. That is why the work focused on these types of clinical trials. Again, ensuring that our enrollees receive the highest quality of care in the most cost-effective manner is core to our beliefs. The voluntary agreement was developed through a thoughtful and considered process with consensus built among varied constituencies to support the best quality research for patients and members. This agreement should not be undone without serious and thoughtful discussion. Concerns about the voluntary agreement can be addressed without a mandate. We are willing to reconvene the work group to review the agreement and update it accordingly. We have met with and are willing to continue to meet with oncologists and other providers about how to administer the agreement. If the committee chooses to pass this bill, the committee members will need to be absolutely clear that this will raise costs. And I'm talking about the bill as it is as introduced. These costs can be passed through to the people who pay for coverage. And let me I just want to follow up here on a couple of minor points. I know there is concern about physicians or people not knowing enough about the fact that this voluntary agreement exists. I would say that in my experience working with the CCOP folks and the Cancer Society and other groups over the past 10 years or 8 years that this agreement has been in place, the physicians and the specialists who work in cancer are well aware of this agreement. There may be some who aren't aware, and we need to do something about that. But I would say, for the most part, it's a very tight-knit community in the oncology community, and they are pretty familiar with clinical trials. They're always looking for opportunities to help their patients to get the very best treatment. And if there's a clinical trial that's available out there, they're going to try to enroll their patient into that clinical trial. The issue of the insurance coverage, as Ms. Rose testified, the health plans are already paying for the routine care costs associated with cancer clinical trials. So we think that one of the unintended consequences of passing this bill or enacting this bill will simply put a bright line out there to the self-funded groups, and they will be, much more aware of the fact that this is something that they can absolutely deny. Some of them know that already, and they do that. They are very concerned about costs, and they have whole benefit departments that work on how to reduce the costs of their employees' health care claims. That said, I think we have a lot of good companies here in Minnesota that would welcome that welcomed the opportunity to learn more about cancer clinical trials.
Representative Lofton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Commit, isn't it true that many of your members also have a, in addition to their nonprofit fully insured plan, have a for-profit business that's affiliated that does third-party administrator of roles with the in the self-insured market?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, I believe that's not accurate. The health plans are, the HMOs are required by law to be nonprofit, but they run their entire business organization as nonprofit entities. None of them sell stock on the stock exchange. They don't run their companies as for-profit entities. They run them as nonprofit entities, and that by a consumer board or what have you, and that's how they conduct their business.
Representative Lofton.
Well, and maybe I'm confused about how they're structured, but they do operate as third-party administrators to these self-insured plans. And my understanding is that some of them use their same company name on a card that you get if you're covered by a self-insured plan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, that is correct. The health plans, large self-funded companies come to the health plans and say, we have, you know, 5,000 employees here in the state of Minnesota, and we want to do well by our employees. We're providing them with health insurance benefits, health coverage benefits. We, as a self-funded employer, are going to pay all those claims ourselves, but we're not in the business. We manufacture something else, or we make cereal or something like that. So that's not our expertise to develop networks of providers and process claims and all those other things. So we'd like to hire you to administer the benefits for us for a fee. And that's how that works. That's an administrative services only plan. And so when an employee of that company gets their health insurance benefits, they typically see a card, an insurance card, that looks just like a card that you or I might have in a fully insured business that will say one of the common health plan names on it. However, what may not be as evident to the enrollee is whether or not the product that they're covered under is with a self-funded plan or a fully insured plan. And that's where I think some of the confusion lies.
Mr. Chair, that was what I wanted to say. I think that in addition to the confusion items that you mentioned, I think it's very confusing to the public who doesn't understand how companies are organized. I've looked at this, and I don't even understand how all the pieces fit together. And so it's really hard for one person who has a life-threatening illness and gets approved to understand when their neighbor with the same coverage, as far as they understand, isn't. And I think that's part of the problem. And my understanding, and maybe this is not correct, is that when they're operating as a third-party administrator for the same reasons that you just explained, they're a company, they're a business, they know how to manufacture things or do whatever service they provide in the market. They're not insurance experts. They don't know how to create health networks. They really turn to that entity for advice on what to cover or not cover. And if that's true, then why do you think when they all meet together in this one entity, why does one branch say, yes, go forward, and the exact same company says under a different line, no, we're not going to cover it, and advise these companies not to cover it?
Ms. Kmet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that question, Representative Loeffler, because that's a great question. There are a lot of self-funded employers out there who let me back up. The health plans work with the self-funded employers. The self-funded employers come to them and say, look, we want to provide benefits to our employees. What does the market typically offer? What's a typical market basket of benefits that an average Minnesotan might get? And the health plans, this is kind of the beauty of having this voluntary agreement. The health plans have tried to incorporate this as part of their overall medical policy so that this is something that's just automatically part of what a self-funded employer offers. And it's only, you know, it's kind of like they have to opt out of that because this is something that we bring forward and say, you know, this really makes sense. Mm-hmm. This is really the right kind of thing to do for your employees. When you have an employee who gets cancer, this is the right thing to do. And typically, many employers are very fine with that, But there are some employers, some of whom have large populations of employees who live here, but maybe the home office is located in another state, and they don't share that same value as what we attempt to instill in our customers that we deal with, our large accounts that we deal with here in Minnesota. And that's the challenge. You're absolutely right. This is a challenge. And this is part of the function. I mean, this is a symptom of our employer-based healthcare system. And that's nothing. This bill will not change any of that.
Does the state of Minnesota, we're self-insured. Do we cover, are we part of, do we have this voluntary agreement?
You do, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. You do, because there's a law in under 43A.23, I think, that which governs your state employee benefits, that says whenever there's a mandate or benefit that's passed in the private market to apply to the fully insured market, that the CGIP program, your health insurance plan, must also do that, with the one exception when the legislature carved itself out of having to follow the up to age 25 dependent care.
Yes.
But otherwise, you do.
And what about the University of Minnesota? I mean, that seems to be the case here, right?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the University of Minnesota used to be a part of the state plan, and some years ago they separated out. And my understanding is that the University of Minnesota is a self-funded plan. And
who's chosen not to abide by the voluntary agreement?
Evidently, that might be part of what's going on. And so it might behoove all of us to get together and talk again and make sure that the University of Minnesota understands that this is a good thing.
Since they do the research, so... Okay. Well, that may be part of the issue. Representative Kahn, you can talk there, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to give a few final words on this. That, one, no one has pointed out anything wrong with the bill. They've actually said clearly when they said there's a problem of are you covering only quality trials, the language in the bill clearly makes sure that you're only covering quality trials. One of the sort of surprising things that we heard from the start from Mr. Pender was that he's usually working on the forefront of a movement, and here there are 23 states that have passed legislation similar to this, and in some sense. So I have problems with this statement that somehow because you have a working voluntary agreement that that's interfered with because you put a state law that backs it. I mean, it seems to me that I haven't, and, you know, again, you know, I understand this is a new difficult concept, which is why I had Mr. Pender explain the bill instead of me, but I just have not heard anything that really, I've not heard any suggestions for any amendments of how it could be, of how it could be improved, of how anything that is wrong with it is. I didn't want to inundate you with papers from, you know, particularly because they have papers from medical journals and so forth, and they're somewhat obtuse. But some of the numbers are, looking at 1 year in Virginia, the amount that could be attributed, could be attributed to this was about 0.3%. The numbers, the annual accrual in any year was very modest, 60 to 100 patients a year. Plus the fact that there are very good evidence that participation in clinical trials is helpful and can, and all of the COVID expenses can reduce other expenses in the long run. But I understand that it's there's a lot of material here, but I just wanted to point those out in my final comments, that we have not heard anything really that says that there's anything wrong with the bill except a philosophical concept.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Does the legislation, is the voluntary agreement, is the legislation broader than the voluntary agreement?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, the legislation is much broader than the voluntary agreement, and we have a problem with that. Again, cancer clinical trials, and it sounds like that's really the interest of the proponents.
If it was only cancer clinical trials, would you be okay with it?
We would be fine with the... limiting it to cancer clinical trials. I would just say again to the committee that our concern about passing a mandate is that it really establishes a bright line that says this is a state mandate, and for the rest of the self-funded employers out there, it will make it easier for them not to do that. And I think it sort of begins to defeat the process. I mean,
this is what I'd like to do. System. I think we're going to lay the bill over, and maybe we can talk about whether we can limit it to cancer clinical trials, and we'll have some time to take it up. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Thank you, Representative Kahn. All right, Representative Bunn. Okay. Oh, yeah, we got plenty of time. Okay. We'll get it done. Representative Bunn moves House File 3269 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. We are revisiting a set of issues that were involved in the dental benefits redesign last year and changes to the critical access dental program. I want to give, as by way of entry, the plan I'm going to follow here is a brief, some introductory comments to give the big picture story here. Then we're going to watch a DVD, so I hope the audience can see it well enough. A very well-produced DVD about the impact of some of the changes we passed last year that many in the communities that work with the providers and patients in this area feel went a bit too far. And then we're going to take up the amendment to the bill before you, so your amendment to your packet. In your packet, I also have a three-word oral amendment that I'll be making at that time. So just to set the context here today, last session the governor proposed to zero out all dental coverage for adults in Minnesota under both medical assistance and Minnesota Care. So there'd be no dental coverage whatsoever. That was in the budget last year. In response to that, I was asked to take a look at this area and to meet with providers and come up with a proposal for a benefit redesign to the program that would meet the most crucial medical needs related to dental while at the same time saving us a great deal of money. The original fiscal note, and I'm not sure it's the very last one that I found today for it, but close to it, saved about $27 million in the first biennium because it wouldn't get implemented right away, and about $50 million for the second biennium if the when we passed that last year, which we did pass. There might be a little bit different numbers than that, though, but that was what we passed. This area of our budget took a larger percent decrease in its funding than probably any other area of the Health and Human Service budget probably. At the initial start of our work, we were looking for 50% reduction. Again, in the very final ones, we were close to that, but there were some changes made in the end. Secondly, the governor then, after we passed this, unallotted the critical access boost to the medical assistance program. They had been receiving a 30% additional payment on top of the regular base rate in order to make sure critical access providers remained viable and that we had that access continue. He kept the access boost on Minnesota Care at that time. This year, so pulling us up to this year, the governor's budget proposes a tremendous decrease in the critical access program. No additional change to the benefit set, but by providing a set of criteria by which you could be designated as a critical access provider that would greatly narrow the number and types of entities that could become those providers, they have booked a great deal of additional savings going forward. The result of their proposal would greatly reduce the number of critical access providers. It would, in particular, eliminate the University of Minnesota Dental Program and its satellites from being considered critical access providers. It would also eliminate both some nonprofit and for-profit providers in Minnesota's dental communities that serve over 10,000 critical access patients at this time. So a very dramatic reduction in critical access provider type programs and designated dentists and clinics. So that's where we were. So this is our response today to two things, which you'll be hearing about. First of all, response to the benefits reductions that we passed last year. They were worked through with a variety of providers in this area. At the time, we knew we were going pretty far because we knew we had many years of budget cuts to deal with. And some of the issues that you'll see in the DVD are things we were concerned about that possibly we crossed the line too far, and it will address that. Secondly, it'd be addressing our response to the governor's proposal.
different approach to the critical access problem, again, by narrowing it and booking some savings on it, but in a different way than the governor has provided. Also, our proposal will have some reform in it that we also hope to provide additional savings. So we'll do the DVD, and then we'll go back to the amendment to the bill. The amendment is the H3269A1 amendment, so you can be getting that out. And this DVD is about 10 minutes long, so we think it's worth it, though, because it's very well done.
Community Dental Care, Maplewood, Minnesota. We have expanded to this place a year and a half ago. We have approximately 85% of our patients are on medical assistance, and 65% of our patients are recent immigrant or immigrant from the Southeast Asian.
Yeah, Sean. Oh, nice. And oh yes, okay. Just that when he bite, then it's really nice.
That is heavy in my heart for to think about Mr. Wang's future under the new rule. To say when the denture break and they will not pay for it. To say that when the denture need reline, you can't have a reline. So like Mr. Wang, if the denture is broken, he probably going to be eating with one denture and chewing on his own gum.
You come all the way from Anoka here?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you for your trust in us. Open, please. Ooh, that is a huge buildup you have.
Not having a job and, relying on support of my family until I can find a job right now, until the economy gets better, I really don't have anything to do. I don't know what to do. You know, the only thing I know what I'm doing right now is getting help through the state until I can get out on my own again.
A young adult would not have this opportunity if you don't have periscaling, replaning, the gum tissue is going to get worse. And eventually this young adult is going to be losing his teeth. There are two things that can cause tooth loss. Number one is caries, number two, periodontal disease. Now they will not get care for periodontal disease. It amazes me that we say, okay, if we have two kinds of disease, the government will take care of one disease but not the other. And both of them cause tooth loss. A lot of our patients will suffer. Probably end up with the hospital across the street. And even right now, the hospital already refer a lot of patients to us, and in the future we're probably going to have to refer a lot of patients to them by the hundreds per year due to pain caused by periodontal disease.
So Apple Tree has trucks, we have mobile dental offices, and we set up those offices for a full day of service year-round. I'm Dr. Michael Helgeson. I'm a geriatric dentist here at Apple Tree. We're very unique in that we provide services at more than 100 locations around the state where we serve some of the most vulnerable children, adults with disabilities, and frail elders in nursing facilities, many of whom have complicated medical problems and face tremendous barriers trying to get dental care.
I'm going to be disabled the rest of my life. Well, I don't think it's right in my case because I can't afford to pay for the dentist. It's like, what is the state for if they don't help us?
You have your partials with you today?
You do? Where?
In my coat pocket.
Oh, in your coat pocket. So we should find.
And now her cleanings are only covered once per year. So with that, she builds up a lot of plaque. She's at a great risk for building up more cavities. Also, we recently made her a partial with the budget cuts as well. Partials are no longer, the repairs are no longer covered. So if a tooth breaks off or if it falls and breaks in half, which does happen in a nursing home, accidents happen, that is also no longer covered.
These cases are our parents' and grandparents' teeth. Most of them are missing some or many of them all of their teeth. And for them to not have these teeth repaired if they've been broken or a clasp added may mean they can't chew. What are we going to ask them to eat? Mush?
Hi, I'm Dr. Dan Rose, a general dentist. I practice in Pillager, Minnesota, a town of about 420 people. I've been practicing dentistry for about 30 years, and these cuts that I see coming down have probably been the most devastating to the population that in most need in the state. I have chosen to care for the most compromised, what I believe to be the most compromised population, and that is the developmentally disabled. This patient right here, he's 21 years old, again, a profoundly retarded patient with a seizure disorder. What they see here is the fact that there is significant inflammation in the gum tissue, and there's a tooth that's just about buried in gum tissue because of the swelling of the gum tissue and the inflammation and the infection that's around there. Even now, before these cuts came into being, I could see this patient once every 6 months. It is already less than the standard of care, because if this were in the quote-unquote normal population, a dentist would be seeing this patient probably every 3 to 4 months. So already, before these cuts, they were already demanding that we provide care that was less than the standard of care, less than the best practice, less than evidence-based dentistry would allow. Now we're cutting that out completely. There's no periodontal maintenance allowed in this, and this young man, as I said before, 21 years old, just because he's profoundly retarded, he's going to lose all his teeth.
My name is John Luth. I am a private practice dentist in Bemidji in Beltrami County, northern Minnesota, and founder and on the board of Northern Dental Access Clinic. My job is to assess a person's oral health and to help them maintain that as best they can. But what I'm faced with is telling them, here's your condition, here are the things that can be done, but you have only one option, for instance, because the state will not pay for this care that could save your tooth or could improve your oral health or will educate you on how to take care of yourself. You're going to lose that tooth. You're not going to get the care, so your gum disease is going to worsen and you may lose more than one tooth.
I'm Mike Flynn in Lewiston, Minnesota, and I'm the dentist at Lewiston Dental Clinic, which serves 70% of the patients on Minnesota healthcare programs. We are the safety net clinic, I would say, for the 8-county area. Well, the cuts for my patients really mean that their access to dental care is probably going to be very limited. With the decrease in benefit sets, we will not be able to do our preventative care that we've been doing for the 31 years I've been in practice.
You're under warranty.
Yeah.
So.
Good morning, Midwest Dental. This is Heather. On average, we do have to turn away 6 to 10 people a day because of their coverage through the state of Minnesota.
You know, we're looking at people that are going to be losing teeth. So I think that's going to affect the way they look, which I think is going to affect how they're feeling about themselves. To me, it doesn't even make sense to put people through that for a few bucks. It's just not worth it. And I think that to me, doing basic, doing x-rays, doing the cleans, helping people save their teeth is also protecting their health.
All right, Norma, we're going to spin around here.
One of my big concerns, especially with this population of individuals, is that they cannot speak for themselves. Many of them simply cannot communicate at all. They're on
numerous medications. They're totally dependent on the state for their well-being and welfare. They will never be a wage earner. They're different than what is normally perceived as the quote-unquote regular MA patient. As I say, they have no voice.
It's taken 25 years to build the infrastructure that AppleTree has to serve these vulnerable populations. And with these cuts, that's going to begin to shred this work, and the safety net itself will begin to fall apart.
How you doing, Neil?
Good.
In a practical sense, what results is a patient may come into our offices, private or the dental access clinic. The best treatment might be to perform a root canal procedure on a molar, and instead that tooth must be extracted. And we're creating dental cripples. And we're also creating a great amount of concern among the practitioners about standards of care and adhering to their professional responsibility to provide the proper standard of care for treatment.
Well, I usually love to first challenge. Maybe I will tell you that first. And the heavy heart comes to know that the patient will suffer, and we will stick with our patient to the end. You know, we probably will die a slow death, but it's going to be worth it.
Thank you for your patience, Mr. Chair and committee members and audience members. We felt that it's important in these challenging times, particularly as we go forward and discuss further cuts in the year ahead. You okay? That we understand the impact of what we're doing. That last list that you saw right at the end is not that we eliminated all preventive or we eliminated all things that list, but we reduced the periodicity of those things. We did eliminate repairs of dentures, et cetera. These were all things we did discuss last year. Some of the items that were mentioned here were some pretty large ticket items, repairs and also the periodontal scaling, some of those kinds of things. In terms of this particular set of issues, and what you saw in the DVD as well, is this population does include the age blind and disabled. And some of the types of benefits and curiosity that might work for the healthy and normal folks among us are more challenging with those populations. We attempted to look at ways to target certain benefits towards that population so they could do it more frequently, et cetera. We have been informed by the department that under federal rules we cannot do that, and we might in the future seek ways to deal with that challenge and get a waiver, but we are not now in this proposal. So, back to the bill. I want to now do the A1 amendment. And so I'd like to move the A1 amendment, and then I'd like to do a three-word change the A1 amendment on line 1.11.
Okay, what's the change?
After the word clinic, I would like to insert the words or dental group on 1.11.
Everybody understand that? All right, that's incorporated.
Okay. And so would like Mr. Scandrett to join me and speak to the changes that the amendment brings to our bill.
Has everybody read the amendment? Do they understand the changes? Okay.
We'll just have him hit the high points for us, make sure you know.
I'm Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Scandrett, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition that represents safety net hospitals, community clinics, dental clinics, mental health centers, and other providers that serve low-income and uninsured populations. And the amendment that's before you is the result of work of a lot of different groups, not just the safety net providers, and there are other people here from the Dental Association and other places that can answer questions if they come up. But the dental community, and again, not just the safety net providers, but the entire community is very concerned about the cuts from last year maybe being too deep. You know, we did step up last year, and you'll remember this, that we tried to come and bring you ways that you could reduce costs in dental care in order to avoid the elimination of the coverage entirely. And well, some of those cuts probably went further than they should have, and we've had a lot of problems since then. So what we're trying to do in the amendment is identify some of those cuts from last year that we think should be restored. We're also very concerned about the unallotment of the critical access dental program in the general fund.
That's what the bill does, is restore those things. Do you want to just put the amendment on? Are you talking about the whole bill with the amendment, or are you talking about just the amendment?
Well, I was providing a little background information, but I sense the chair would like me to get right to the amendment.
That would be helpful.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll briefly explain the amendment. The original bill had some more specific criteria for eligibility to get the critical access enhanced payments. And we've learned that that original bill language, there are some providers that we all acknowledge are safety net providers that were cut out by that definition. So we're adding some additional categories that you can see in the amendment and read them that bring in some large clinical groups that that even though they don't meet the threshold, they have large numbers of low-income populations, and to bring the educational institutions that have clinics into the mix as well. Mm-hmm. And then we'll continue to work on this, but we're trying to make the language regarding the disqualification of people for critical access payments to get it down to just those things that are more serious or represent patterns of problems and not have innocent mistakes in billing or paperwork result in being disqualified. And we're not there yet, and I'll just let you know we're continuing to work on language with the author. But this represents improvement, and we'll continue to work on those things until we get language that we think will narrow the range of organizations that are eligible, but in a positive way by preserving the money for those that truly have significant populations and will be severely harmed by the lower payment rates. And then the final thing, too, is related to the funding for critical access dental. I know that's not an issue for this committee, but due to the unallotment, we did lose the medical assistance, or we are about to lose the medical assistance portion of the payments. And so we did include in the amendment bringing some of that money back at a lower funding level, but we'll just have to take our chances in the Finance Committee to see whether there's any money to be had for either these restoration of cuts or for restoring some of the critical access dental payments.
And how much was the reduction in critical access dental payments in the unallotment?
Does anybody know? I think,
Mr. Chung,
I believe it for fiscal year 11 is about $6.2 million, somewhere around there.
So, Mr. Chair, the part that's being added back here is less than that because it assumes the reduced critical access provider program under this bill.
Okay.
That we wouldn't need, we're not restoring the entire unallotment. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's the, yeah. All right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Questions, Representative Loffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Bonner. Mr. Scandrett, I really appreciate what you're doing and trying to work on this, but I did note in the amendment that with all the other definitions of who qualifies, there's a threshold of service, mm-hmm. and that isn't included in the oral health or dental education program operated by the university or MNSCU, and having seen over the past decades that the U of M has somewhat backed away from its previous safety net role, mm-hmm. I'm wondering if we might want, as this moves forward, seek some kind of a proportion for them as well.
Mr. Scandrett.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, just to be clear, we are intending that the University of Minnesota Clinics would be eligible. We believe they should be eligible, and that's what the purpose of the amendment is.
Just to clarify, my intent was that they be eligible as well. I just think they should have a threshold of participation of the patients described here as well, that so that they, like all the others, have to have a significant amount of these patients.
Yeah, and do we know what their what percentage of their patients are underserved?
Mr. Chair, we do have the Dean of the University of Minnesota Dental School in the audience, if you would like, and his staff, too, if they'd like to address that.
Okay.
If you don't have time, we wouldn't.
No, let's do that. I think that's worthwhile to find out.
Chairman, it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. I just want to clarify,
In 2004, our population that we took care of at our Twin Cities campus was roughly 24% public assistance. As we speak, it's 32%. Mm-hmm. We had 105,000 patients visit last year. 32% of those were on medical assistance. At our outreach clinics, we had 17,000 visits last year. 92% of those patients were on public assistance. So when we're looking at a standard where we are, increase just a small percentage on 105,000 is not an insignificant number. Mm-hmm. And we have made great strides in hiring faculty, remodeling facilities, expanding clinics to do a better job at fulfilling our public obligation. Mm-hmm. It's unprecedented.
And this would cover Wilmer?
Yes, Wilmer, Hibbing, our mobile dental van, and our cooperative relationships with the Cook Clinic, the North Point Clinic, two local long-term care centers, and then another program that we're working on right now within the community that is yet to be publicly announced.
Okay. Thank you. Help. Okay. Mr. Lally.
I think
you're okay.
I think he's decided not to speak. Yeah.
Okay. We love it. Excellent. All right. Any other questions, members? Okay, thank you so much for your work. And Mr. Scandrett, thank you, too, for all your work, wherever you went now. Okay, thank you. The A1 amendment, all in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill? Anybody else want to testify? All right, seeing none, Representative Bunn renews her motion that House File 3269, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bunn. Representative Tao moves that House File 3178 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Representative Tao.
Thank you. I don't have a video, so. Several years back, the legislature created a roster for medical interpreters. And the cost the state, I believe, $50,000, Representative Huntley, to create the roster. We're hoping that more interpreters sign up to be on it. So far, we have 100. And this bill will encourage them to sign. Essentially, it says if you're going to get reimbursed with state money, you have to be on the roster. Essentially, it takes about 24 hours to get on the roster and $50. So essentially, that's the bill.
Okay. Now, Representative Abler.
Well, this is a good start. This whole thing about interpreters is just some of the fees that get charged are more than the fee the physician gets paid. And so this is a good start. Hope someday there's a fee schedule, and maybe that'll move along and later on. But this is a good start.
And the registry, the purpose of the registry is to make sure that they're actually qualified and understand medical terms and that kind of thing?
The difference between a roster, the idea for the roster is just for anyone to sign up and identify themselves as a medical interpreter. The registry, there's probably going to be some requirement, minimum requirement, understanding of both English and the native language that they're speaking, and some ethical courses that they're going to have to take. And so slowly it's moving towards building some credentialing and qualities.
So this just requires them to get their name on the roster and pay the fee that helps assume, presumably pay for the roster and the registry process.
That's right.
Okay. Is that an annual fee?
I believe so.
Okay. And Representative Rudin.
Mr. Chair. And Representative Tao, thank you. This is an issue that's near and dear to my heart. We've had some discussions about this, but what about, do agencies have to sign up? Is this for individuals? I know our facility I work at,
Representative Tao.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rood, this is just for the individual interpreter, so each interpreter have to sign up themselves. Essentially, the way the bill's drafted is, if you're not on the roster, we won't use the state money, and so each individual interpreter will have to be on the roster themselves, so not the agencies. Did you want the agencies to be on it?
Representative Rudin.
Well, no, sir. I'm just wondering how that will work, because we usually contract with an agency and then they send out, so it's going to be the individual interpreters are going to be responsible for this piece of it, not necessarily their agency.
Right.
Just say right again.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Tao, I guess I'm just wondering, I don't see anybody on the agenda that's scheduled to testify either for it or in opposition, and I just want to ask you, are you aware of any opposition to this, or, you know, what would the opposition be?
I'm not aware of it, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling. I'm not aware of any. This, when we had the first original bill to create the roster, there was a tremendous amount of people in support of it, so. And I have not checked my email, so that might be it, too.
Representative Norton.
Just clarifying, and you did say you're moving, this is moving toward a certification process, because I guess questions that come off the top of my head are, how do you guarantee quality, and what if somebody complains, and is there a process for if someone complains about an interpreter not doing their job? So those kinds of things come to mind, and also criminal background checks for folks who would do this that I would think at some point, you know, maybe this isn't the time, maybe that's at the next step, but those are things that come to mind immediately that I hope we'll address, yeah, in licensing committee next year.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Norton, that is the hope of this bill, and the stakeholders group, I would like them to move a little faster than they are, but the plan is to get to that point so we could have some quality and ensure quality. Right now, the fear is if we move so fast that there will be a work shortage, or there will be a shortage of interpreters, and so that's kind of why we're doing this snail pace.
And I think I just heard Representative Norton volunteer to be on licensing again. So that's good. Okay. So any further discussion? All right, House File, Representative Tyler News' motion that House File 3178 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Huntley, and this is now I'm going to bring up Representative Huntley's bill from the table. Any discussion on that motion? This is the electronic records bill. Any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is before us. We had an extended discussion of the bill last week. We've had some further preliminary discussions of what really isn't part of the bill, but this discussion of the contracting process and how we got to the place we are today. I think we're going to continue those discussions and perhaps have another hearing about that separately from this. So just with that preliminary, those preliminary remarks, is there questions about the bill? Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've not talked to anybody about this in the meantime, but I actually wish someone would have come and talked to me, but my concerns I had before about that other thing are just as profound as ever. And I have a question that I think relates to that. On line 230, the new language, is this Minhai?
Mr. Gold, Dr. Gold.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, no, this is no particular organization. It would be any organization that is providing health information exchange services.
And so Mr. Chair, a state certified health data intermediary, that wouldn't be Minhai. Who would that be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, perhaps the best way to describe what this bill is doing, again, just to remind the committee, is essentially think about this as cell phones, because I know that is an analogy that has been used. So the idea is if you wanted to have a cell phone coverage for the entire state, what a certified health information exchange organization would be the carrier that is providing cell phone service. So, for example, AT&T or Sprint would be the certified health information organizations. What the bill does is say if you want to be a health information organization, you have to follow these requirements. Anyone who might be interested could be a health information organization, provided that they follow those requirements. It could be CHIC out of Duluth. It could be Minhai out of the Twin Cities. And so in this case, what it is saying is that in order to meet the interoperability requirement, you have to connect to one of the carriers. It could be AT&T, it could be Sprint, it could be whomever. What the other portions of the bill do is say that those organizations need to interoperate with each other according to certain criteria so that they're able to exchange information. So that if a provider connects to one of the services, they're able to exchange information with the other services. Just like if you have Sprint and you want to make a phone call, it doesn't matter that you're using Sprint, it goes to AT&T just as well.
So just, and I'm not trying to belabor this, but I just don't understand it. I think you and I need to sit down and talk about this. But you said MNHI in the Twin Cities. And so would they be defined as a state-certified health information organization, or would they be an intermediary?
Dr.
Of the two terms you have there, are they one of those?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, we aren't defining any organization as anything. What we are doing is we are saying any organization that wants to be a health information organization needs to satisfy these criteria that are laid out in the bill.
The question is, would MNHI be, you know enough about
yes.
MNHI, would it
and,
be?
And my understanding is that both MNHI and CHIC have every intention of applying and trying to become a health information organization.
Thank you. That helps for now. I'm not going to go into our other objections that we talked about. I think that was an interesting and enlightening chat we had on the congressman's commentary. So there's two areas of main concern I have that about the bill. I'd like to make a motion, if I can, about
you leading. You certainly can.
Okay. And I haven't talked to anybody, so I don't know what people think about this. There's two parts that especially are concerning to me on the face of it, my understanding. On line 621, paragraph G there, I'm extremely uncomfortable with the ill-defined nature of what a clear and present danger to public health or safety is, and I'm very nervous that this could cause a release of data that people wouldn't necessarily agree that this is a bad enough one, so I would instead move to delete paragraph G, which is line 6.21 to 6.24.
President Huntley or Dr. Golden?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I can tell you what this is for. This is the, if you look up at E on 612, this is where the Health Information Exchange Oversight Board can actively investigate issues around situations where a health information organization may not be complying with the requirements for such an organization. During such time as the investigation is going on, all information that Oversight Board has is classified as investigatory data and is not public information. Once the investigation is complete, in paragraph F, all of the information that was part of that investigation is public. However, there may be situations that in the course of the investigation demonstrate that a health information organization is acting in a way that could be quite dangerous to a patient. A clear example would be perhaps there is something wrong with the mechanism that helps identify where a patient's record is, or perhaps they are sending information that is incorrect about the patient. So they're sending wrong information. And so what this is really trying to do is to say that if during under paragraph E, as part of the investigation, something comes to light that would create a danger particularly for patients, that information could be released to the appropriate agency or person to address that situation. It will eventually become public under F, but as part of the investigation, this just allows the information to be made public earlier to address that standard. This is very consistent with other regulatory authorities that exist, particularly in the Department of Commerce, and this was language that was taken from those sections and brought into this.
Mr. Chair, I'm not comforted.
The Liebling has a...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just to the point, just to paraphrase what you just said, I mean, am I correct in understanding that this does not refer to any patient data?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Abel.
Well, I guess this needs more at least explanation to me. I just, as I read it, it's just very vague, and it doesn't talk about an individual. It talks about public health or safety. That would be some group, and this would be, I don't think this is a good section, and I think I'll withdraw my motion to delete it, but this is not crisp. It's not what you said, and this is heavily on my mind, and it's going to create a stir on the floor. And if it's this white hat stuff, let's make it clean and crisp. Instead of saying an appropriate person or agency, whatever appropriate is a very subjective term. A clear and present danger is in the eye of the beholder. If you remember President Nixon and all that stuff that we talked about, they thought it was a danger, but other people didn't agree. And public health or safety is extremely undefined. I don't believe it's defined in the bill. And so it's a problematic paragraph. And I think if you mean what you said, let's tighten up the language and I'll help you with that. I think then I'll support this paragraph. Mr. Chair, I have another area I'd like to...
Motion is...
So, is you want to react?
Although I think that probably could be... I don't disagree that probably could be tightened up if that's what you're trying to... If you're trying to amend paragraph E, it may make more sense to just put the amendment up in paragraph E. Okay.
Mr. Chair, the last thing, which I am extremely concerned about, if I may make a motion to delete subdivision 5, which is pages 16.8 and to 16.10. And especially given the concerns expressed before and actually the lack of clarity of some of the answers that we've been able to receive here, I think the idea of using expedited rulemaking where there's virtually no input is not responsible for us to continue. And I have no coalition of people I'm working on this, but I think as a committee we should be concerned to give this kind of authority on this much new language with $400 to $800 million at hand, and who's going to get their fingers on that. And so I would move to delete the lines 16.8 to 16.10. And they'll have to have some way to pass this, and so they could come back with language that would be more normal rulemaking, which would be my suggestion.
Okay. 16.8 to 16.11?
Sorry.
Okay. That's the motion. Representative Huntley or Dr. Golden?
We're under a very short timeline because we want this to be started by, January 1, 2011? And typically, if you go without expedited rulemaking, it's going to take more than a year.
That's correct. Mr. Chair, committee members, there are a variety of things that are happening at the federal level which we will need to be responsive to as a state in having a governance structure for the various HIOs. Among them is, right now, CMS has a notice of proposed rulemaking, which is open, that will define the meaningful use criteria for 2011. They have already indicated that the meaningful use criteria will change for 2013 as well as for 2015. At this point, we don't know what those requirements are likely to be. This was put in an effort to make sure that we had adequate flexibility in order to adjust what might be needed in governance to meet those requirements. From a state agency's perspective, our preference is actually to come back to the legislature. Rulemaking is rather onerous for an agency. Even expedited rulemaking has a tremendous amount of process and time frame associated with it. We have been in front of this committee 3 out of the last 4 years with e-health bills. I think we've made it clear that our preference is actually to come here and have a public discussion and actually put it into statute. That's much easier for us as well. But in order to make sure we have flexibility for what we know is going to change, we suggest keeping this rulemaking authority.
Further discussion on the amendment? Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, I support this because I have a very hard time with all the definitions
support
here. The amendment, okay. The motion to delete this. And I have not seen the hospital industry, the medical providers, the dentists, anyone even staying around to even understand it, let alone step up and support it. And yet it's going to cover every single transaction that they do. It's got fees, transaction fees that are authorized in here. I mean, I think we've put a lot of effort on healthcare cost containment, and this one feels like it's kind of, I think it's a necessary part of the infrastructure, but if you build a freeway that nobody realizes it's there until all of a sudden you require them to go on it, and it doesn't work for them. I just kind of feel like the public process of rulemaking does get everybody kind of more engaged, and there may be other ways to do it, You have time before you go to government ops to potentially have a broader set of stakeholders provide that input as you're moving forward. So I think there's some other ways to do it, but I think it's a way of just saying we want to have some real serious engagement in this.
Representative
Hulley. Mr. Chair and members, I have a letter here, just came today, from the Hospital Association, and they support the bill the way it is.
Further discussion on the amendment? Representative Abler renews his motion. Representative Liebling.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, but just a question. I don't know anybody who could answer this for me, but, well, first of all, is this bill going, where is it going next?
Civil justice.
And then to state government.
Okay, it is going to state government.
And
okay.
Then it comes back to finance.
Okay. I guess what I would say, I would oppose the amendment for now. Not that I don't see the concern, Representative Loeffler, but it does give me some comfort that it's going to state to GovOps, right? Because
yes.
They're the people that talk about rulemaking, and I feel like I'm at a bit of a loss because I don't really understand the process well enough, and I know you do, Representative Loeffler. You've had more experience with this, but you know what is gained and lost in the rulemaking process, and so the fact that it's going to that committee does give me some comfort and would allow me to vote no on the amendment, leave the bill as it is, and you know, and hope that they'll take a look at that issue.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
I'm sincere in my concern. I don't know where the votes lie on this particular amendment. This does have a ways to go. But I think that the department needs to understand that there's serious reservations from this member and I think from many members about some of this stuff. And I think with that I'll withdraw the motion. But I didn't do it just to call attention. It was both those were serious ideas, serious concerns. And I think that some of this stuff, just because the hospitals agree with something, and with all respect, I appreciate their letter, but there's some people at home that think we're looking after them. And I'm not any kind of paranoid person, but I'm a sensible, reasoned provider for a long time. I know how data goes, and this is not ready to become law yet. And I hope as the process unfolds that people will have a chance to weigh in, and there's many committees for that. So I hope that the author sees me as a friendly partner in the topic, with a few concerns about the implementation. And with that, I'll yield. Thank you.
Representative Love.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the one thing that I would ask the Department of Health to really think about as we move forward, this is really going to be a key part of our infrastructure forever. And I think it's an important part. But I think it's important that it be designed in a way that we can understand it and communicate about it. And maybe I'm just alone in this, but I've read this bill several times. I cannot in my head keep track of all these names that all kind of sound alike. And there's a lot of definitions that seem to be missing. But the ones that even that you have a health data intermediary, a health information exchange, which I thought was a thing, but it's a verb. It's a thing, a transaction. There's a health information exchange service provider, a health information organization, a major participating entity, and a participating entity. And those are way too many things that use the exact same words that have nuances that are probably important. And so I'm just hoping that you'll go back to the drawing board and try and come up with some plainer, cleaner language that actually kind of uses labels that explain the role and that have definitions, because I think the best policy is ones and the best systems are ones that all the actors that are engaged can understand. And I've really tried. I can't straighten this one out in my head. And I'm you guys have done a lot of good stuff, but when we pass bills, we should know what all these different things are.
You know, and the only other thing, and I've had a conversation with some members, and this does relate a little bit to our discussion last week, is in terms of all these the board, in particular the oversight board, and I don't know what, and this is probably a GovOps issue as well, but what kind of conflict of interest rules apply and who sits on the board versus who sits on some of these people that could be applying to the board for applications, and including the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health, which are both, you know, they're separate departments, but both agencies of the state government. I think we really need to think through, just for, you know, appearances, if not just transparency. And adding some kind of conflict of interest policy to this bill, I think, would improve it a great deal.
Mr. Chair, we would certainly be willing to work with you to add a conflict of interest. We have.
Or you can work with Representative Loeffler, maybe not me, but. No, any of us. I'm kidding.
So. We would certainly be willing to do that, and absolutely. I would just point out one thing in relation to your comment. The bill does prohibit the Department of Health from being a member of the board. We are simply responsible for staffing it.
Mm. Right. Okay.
And Mr. Chair, the last thing that, and I think it will ultimately end up in Chair Huntley's committee, is I really do think you have to look hard at whether or not we need to set the fees right now when it's still in a developmental stage. And to what degree is the oversight and the compliance being done by the feds versus us? I mean, a $20,000 annual certification fee is a significant cost addition. And, you know, I'm hoping that this is really based on a national platform and there's almost nothing for each state to do, so that it's really, if you end up in Wisconsin or you end up in, you know, California having a problem, it all works out just great in terms of sharing information. And I think that's the way it's evolving too. So I kind of see this as a transition point. And I just wouldn't, I think you should think about that as we move forward, as to how do we keep these costs really at the minimum.
Yeah. I actually do have one more question. That is kind of this analogy of the cell phones. So this technology, so you can have different companies that would be the HIOs, that would be the Verizons and AT&Ts, right? Who chooses the technology that allows them to communicate? Is that going to be different state to state, or is that going to be a national platform?
The standards by which they communicate will be set by the national government, and those will be national standards. Just as, for example, the best example today would be Sprint and AT&T. Those are two technologies that are very, very different technologies. The phones for Sprint will not work with AT&T and vice versa, not just because they're locked. But they still are able to exchange phone calls because they're using the same telecommunication standards to be able to exchange that information. So who actually selects the technology will be the various companies can use whatever technology, and as long as their technology is able to use the national standards to communicate that information, they will be in full compliance with Minnesota law.
And this bill is not choosing any particular baseline standard for that, those uniform standards. That's the national standards, and you're just saying to qualify to be one of those companies, you have to meet the national standards, essentially.
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. Oh. The federal government has laid out three roles. The federal government sets the standards by which these organizations will communicate with each other. The states are responsible for governance, and one of the primary reasons that they are putting the states in charge of the governance is because we have such a variety of state privacy laws around the country. And then the private sector is really supposed to be doing the technological innovation around what is the technology that implements these standards.
Okay. All right. So, any further discussion on the bill? All right. Then Representative Huntley will renew his motion that House File 3279
as amended.
Was it amended? Okay. As amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Civil Justice. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. And Representative Huntley, do you have an announcement? Do you want to?
For the members of my committee, there is a joint meeting. It's not an official committee meeting on the GAMC proposal that we have made, and but I'm not
room 15 in the Capitol.
Yeah, room 15
at
4:30. At 4:30.
Okay.
So if you wish to attend, you might learn what's been going on.
Is it a meeting of the House and Senators? Is it sponsored by the two chairs, more or less?
Yes, I think that's right, and you're welcome. And I think it's public, right?
It's a public meeting. We invited the press.
Yeah.
So. Okay. Is the governor coming?
I don't know. All right. With that, we are adjourned. And thank you, everyone.